This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
June 8th and 10th, hundreds of citizens representing grassroots and labor organizations held 3 days of protests and workshops in St. John, New Brunswick, against a new proposed free trade corridor euphemistically titled Atlantica. Encompassing the four Canadian Atlantic provinces, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, and Newfoundland, as well as the New England states of Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, and upstate New York, Atlantica is described by its proponents as an attempt to create an infrastructural corridor between these regions. The Atlantica initiative would involve creating a series of highways and railways linking Atlantic Canada with New England, upgrading the port of Halifax to accommodate large post-Panamax cargo ships, further integrating the power grid and energy resources between the two regions, and even creating what Atlantica's website calls an integrated perimeter security along the U.S.-Canadian border between Maine and New Brunswick. Proponents of the Atlantica International Economic Region claim that it will bring economic prosperity to both Atlantic Canada and New England. However, critics of this initiative believe that Atlantica may involve a much more dangerous agenda, one which proposes to integrate Canadian social, economic, military, security, and immigration policy with those of the United States. Maude Barlow, the national chair of the Council of Canadians, is one of these critics. She believes that Atlantica's origins lie with the creation of the 2005 Security and Prosperity Partnership Agreement between the member countries of the North American Free Trade Agreement.
So in Waco, Texas, in March of 2005, Vicente Fox of Mexico, George Bush of the United States, and Paul Martin of Canada signed the Security and Prosperity Partnership for North America. And then they came back to their respective countries, and they ordered all of their government departments to begin this process. One of the things that we agreed to in our country was that every department was to go through what's called a smart regs process, which is that they're to look at all their regulations to be sure that they're not prohibitive to trade, cross-border trade, in other words, higher than what the trade people would want. So, in other words, deregulation. But more importantly, then they were to have meetings with their counterparts in the United States, whether it's food and seeds or health and, you know, or energy or environment or whatever, to make sure that we're harmonizing our systems across the border so there are no differences. So, I mean, they're talking about a tested once policy. So if something's been okayed in the U.S., like BGH, which we rejected in Canada, you wouldn't have the ability to have a different standard here. So it's very far-reaching what they're talking about and very, in my opinion, very negative. So when I look at Atlantica, I look at that as the Atlantic regional prototype of this big project. And you should know that the Privy Council was tasked with bringing this whole project to subnational governments. They had a meeting this past March in which they brought people from business groups and politicians from across the country, and they're probably going to have five of these regional projects, Atlantica being the first. So this is a subset of the Fortress North America project. And it is the same model. It's the business community coming from the two sides of the border, coming together, putting a blueprint for what they want, which is, of course, harmonized downward social structures, infrastructures, regulatory regimes, environmental standards, and so on, to increase cross-border trade.
Brian Lee Crowley, the president of the Atlantic Institute for Market Studies, one of the major proponents of Atlantica, disagrees with Barlow. He believes that the further integration of economic ties between Atlantic Canada and New England, two regions Crowley considers naturally linked by geography and culture, will put an end to their shared heritage as have-not regions in North America.
You know, my work on Atlantica has made me understand that while we in Canada have a tendency to think about Atlantic Canada as being a poor region within Canada, my experience is now that it is in fact part of a larger relatively underdeveloped region within North America, which includes northern New England and upstate New York. And those are places that have lost a lot of economic activity over the years, a lot of manufacturing. There's been deindustrialization. So we actually share with them a lot of similar economic distress. And the idea behind Atlantica is that it seems pretty clear to me that if we've got a natural economic region here with an international border that runs through the middle of it, that border and its effects on the economy may be part of the explanation of why we're having some of the economic difficulties that we are. We happen to be kind of a crossroads between the demand that exists in North America for manufactured goods and the goods that are coming from the growing economies of India and China. And the thing is that those goods could come to Halifax and then move across Atlantica to their final destinations. Or they could go to New York, or they could go to L.A. or Long Beach or Seattle or Vancouver or lots of other places.
The Atlantic Institute for Market Studies, of which Mr. Crowley is the president, is funded by a who's who of corporations and business elites in Atlantic Canada. Its funders include Irving Oil, the Bank of Montreal, Emera, Sobeys, and Alliant Incorporated. Crowley himself states that the proposed Atlantica region would build upon the NAFTA agreement, and claims that this initiative would allow Atlantic Canada and New England to take advantage of the opportunities presented by NAFTA. Yet others disagree that NAFTA has presented opportunities or substantial benefits for the Atlantic region. Andrew Jackson is a senior economist with the Canadian Labour Congress.
So if we go back to the late 80s, at one level, this process was about tariff reductions, it was about easier cross-border trade, and it was certainly about much easier cross-border flows of investment. And since that period, we indeed have seen quite a dramatic increase in the level of integration between the Canadian and U.S. economies. We saw a huge wave of industrial restructuring in Canada in the late 80s and early 90s, a big round of initial job losses. And we should recall that what this process was really about, what it was sold to us on the basis of, was that it was going to create a basis for growth and for shared prosperity. That's always the line. This is good for the economy. The gains of the economy will be shared. This agenda is good for all of us. But I think we always have to bear in mind that these kinds of trade and investment agreements and more open borders as defined by them results in a major sort of shift in the power relationship in our society from working people towards mobile transnational capital. It's companies that can threaten now much more effectively to move production, jobs, and new investment.
Mary Boyd of the MacKillop Center for Social Justice is a longtime social justice activist based in Prince Edward Island. She, too, has seen some of the effects of the NAFTA agreement in the region.
Well, you know, if you ask the farmers if things have improved, they'll tell you that things have got much worse in agriculture, and now the whole system of supply management is being threatened by NAFTA. We're failing to create jobs to keep young islanders on Prince Edward Island. They're going to Alberta. Whole communities are being robbed of their youth and their future because they can't find a place on PEI. We're starting to bring in migrant workers, and that's giving fodder to the Atlantic Institute of Market Studies to attack islanders who are receiving unemployment insurance. And there's been a massive undermining of unemployment insurance since NAFTA.
One concern to critics of Atlantica has been the notion of public policy distress factors, as outlined on Atlantica's website, www.atlantica.org. According to the website, these distress factors include minimum wage legislation, union density, the size of Atlantic Canada's public workforce, and the size of its government relative to the economy. The website further uses the social policies of Ontario and Alberta as a model to compare those pursued by the Atlantic Canadian provinces. Critics cite these distress factors as evidence that Atlantica will involve a campaign of regressive social policy directed at reducing minimum wages, decertifying unions, and cutting the public sector workforce. Maud Barlow also believes that the comparison with Ontario and Alberta is no accident.
Alberta under Ralph Klein and Ontario under Harris. Now, it has been reversed to some extent with the new government, although we still have some problems with public-private partnerships and so on. But these provinces, and now British Columbia, of course, are provinces that have just equated prosperity with a form of economic system that basically is a race to the bottom that says that to get prosperous, we have to offer the best conditions to big business, which is the fewest regulations, environmental, social safety net, whatever, the lowest minimum wages, a precarious workforce. It's the Walmartization of the workforce, basically, so that people, workers cannot ask for permanent jobs and or pensions and that kind of thing, that they just take the job and are grateful, and that is basically anti-union. And so brings in legislation to undermine or destroy unions and unionized workplaces. That's the model that was brought into these provinces, and that's the model that big business prefers because, of course, that's how they make the most money.
Shut it down! Shut it down! Shut it down!
Conference entitled Reaching Atlantica, Business Without Borders, held between June 8th and 10th in St. John, New Brunswick, drew hundreds out in protest against the Atlantica initiative. The conference's main sponsors were Irving Oil and the Bank of Montreal, as well as the federally funded Atlantic Canadian Opportunities Agency, or ACOA. Panels and workshops on topics ranging from tourism to transportation and energy were held throughout the weekend. Conference participants paid a $595 entry fee for the privilege of taking part. Although some representatives of labor organizations attended the conference, the vast majority of attendees were clearly wealthy, mostly male, and painfully white. Attendees included representatives of business and chambers of commerce, but also included a few federal, provincial, and municipal government representatives.
I know the incredible responsibility that I have as an individual and being a part of a company when I'm responsible for developing something like an LNG terminal. I know that I have to do it in a way that's not just responsible to the economics of the project, but responsible to this place that I'm...
The keynote energy speaker at the conference was none other than Kenneth Irving, CEO of J.D. Irving Limited. Irving, one of Atlantic Canada's biggest corporations, owns a number of businesses throughout Atlantic Canada in the areas of transportation, food services, forestry, oil and gas, construction, and retail. Just as Irving was beginning his speech on the second day of the conference, a group of protesters attempted to rush into the St. John Trade and Convention Center, where the conference was being held. Police arrested two protesters as well as a local blogger, Charles Leblanc. Leblanc would be released without charge the next day, although police would erase all photos he had taken of the arrest of another demonstrator. A second demonstrator was separated from the protest by two officers and was then led away without being informed that he was under arrest. Several individuals who were documenting, recording, or questioning this arrest were threatened by police.
There's no charge whatsoever?
No idea. I don't know. You're going to have to ask the arresting officers later on.
Can I ask what the charge is?
No, you may not right now. We're in the middle of an investigation.
Hey, come on.
Part of Atlantica's energy strategy involves linking a liquefied natural gas pipeline from St. John down the eastern seaboard to the lower United States. LNG, whose parent company is Irving Oil, will be undertaking the construction of a proposed natural gas storage terminal near St. John. Irving believes that Atlantica will bring prosperity to New Brunswick by facilitating the export of oil and gas resources to New England and through them, the rest of the United States. However, Dave Thompson, head of the conservationist organization the Friends of Rockwood Park, believes that the real impacts of Atlantica's energy strategy are already becoming apparent to communities in New Brunswick.
We've already seen what can happen with this proposed Atlantica situation. They've already started an Atlantica Center for Energy in St. John. It's been going now for about a year. And the first thing that they've done, they made an attack on our city and our large nature park, Rockwood Park, by proposing to put a natural gas pipeline for export to the United States right through the park, fracturing the park and through about nine neighborhoods in the city. With no concern about the people, we have over 14,000 signatures on petitions, and they're unwilling to look at alternatives.
Members of the Friends of Rockwood Park were among approximately 400 people who marched from a hockey rink to the St. John Convention Center on a rainy Saturday afternoon on the last day of the Reaching Atlantica conference. Within a small community like St. John, the turnout was very high and very significant. Speakers at the rally consisted largely of labor leaders, despite the considerable presence of grassroots organizations. Newfoundland Federation of Labor President Reg Ansey pledged to continue fighting against the Atlantica proposal.
I spent perhaps the two most excruciating days of my life in those meetings. I'm telling you, it was not a friendly atmosphere for working people. Today, at the beginning of the meeting, the first order of business was to scorn Maude Barlow. The last thing that this board said this morning that I couldn't stomach anymore, I had to get out. The last thing they talked about was that there's going to be a massive amount of truck drivers that are going to be needed. But they're not going to use Canadian truck drivers, by the way. They think it's time now to bring truck drivers up from Mexico. And God love the Mexican people. I've got nothing against the Mexican people. But their idea was to bring Mexican people up to Canada so that they can use cheaper wages, and they've got no benefits and they've got no rights. And I say no to that. That's absolutely inherently wrong. And I've got one last message. I got one last message for the people that are pushing Atlantica. The labor movement will hound you. We will hound you everywhere you go. We will hound you until you're defeated. We will do it in the streets. We will do it in the labor councils. We will do it in Kilpie. We will do it with the postal workers. If we had to, we will do it in the legislatures. You will not get away with selling our country. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast documentary about Atlantica, a proposed trade corridor linking Atlantic Canada and the New England states of Vermont, Maine, New Hampshire, and upstate New York. For more information or to get involved in educating people in your community about Atlantica, check out www.stopatlantica.com. This radio program was produced in Halifax, Nova Scotia for CKDU Radio. My name is Stuart Neeby.